This is the Ed Non-Tech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigway, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Matthew Stranick, and I am in Kamloops, British Columbia, on the traditional lands of Tkamluk-Dishequetmik within Shequetmik-Ulu, the traditional and unceded territory of the Shequetmik people. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 29 of the Ed Non-Tech Podcast. Dr. Matt and Dr. Doug here with you. Hope everything's going well this late spring, early summer for you. How are you doing today, Doug?
Good. I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing?
Yeah, real well. I've kind of put it out there on social media to an extent or whatnot, but I guess just to sort of preface the conversation to come, and probably a few of the conversations that we're going to have down the stretch, I am now, I can officially say, employed. I have a job. It's on the other side of the country. It's in St. John, New Brunswick, and as well as sort of having a lot of family and friends and personal connections in sort of the southern New Brunswick area generally, which is really pretty awesome just kind of in and of itself. It is an opportunity to work in a new industry. So, without naming the employer, particularly, I mean, not that there's any reason not to really, but, I'm in the security industry, starting in about a month's time, starting, the 17th of July. So, everything that I'm sort of looking at now in terms of these topics and whatever is sort of being informed through the lens of a, you know, kind of, having a context now to speak from, an institutional or organizational context, but then as well, this whole lens of, you know, security, defense, police contracting and things like this. This is pretty new to me and my whole, you know, thinking on this stuff. So on the whole, I'm really looking forward to the challenge. And again, I kind of mentioned this one of the last episodes. Somebody who was kind of higher up in the organization and involved in the hiring process, actually, you know, he caught some of the episodes of this Ed Non-Tech podcast through LinkedIn because I posted it there, and he told me straight up that he enjoys what we're doing. So good on us, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, that's what's going on with me, which sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but you know, just one day, one week at a time. I got a pretty manageable setup here. One thing I'll refer to, frequent observers of this podcast will note that historically there has been a coffee table in this back area. There isn't now because as of yesterday night, I gave it away on Facebook to whoever wanted to get it first. So you can expect chairs and L couches and things like that to be disappearing from the frame by the next time we do this. Anyhow, that's what's going on with me. How's it going with you, Doug?
Good, good. I'm just happy to hear your good news.
Yeah, it is good news. Yeah.
The rain has wiped out about a third of my pumpkin crop, so...
Dang! Sorry to hear that, friend.
I don't know what I'm doing, so if I can get a couple of pumpkins at the end of the year, my $8 investment in seeds will be worth it, because it's all a learning experience for me.
Well, a lot of sweat equity in prepping the garden or the patch, I suppose. Yep. What else are you growing? I'm just pretending in my mind this is like behind your house. Is it behind your
it's
house?
It's in front.
In front of your house. Okay. And you're growing like other items besides pumpkins in the surrounding vicinity, or What's the corn, whole ecosystem there look like, pal?
The corn, potatoes, sunflowers, onions, like just the stuff when you think of like a maritime garden. It's just those sorts of things.
Well, we do have listeners. You've informed me. We've had at least one listener from as far away as New Zealand. So,
as per those awesome partners,
yeah.
No, I got a phone call from a guy in Australia who called and told me he liked the way this podcast made him think. Because so many podcasts are just entertainment, and this forces him to think about stuff, which I took as a compliment.
Surely. So this is one of your former colleagues from when you were in Australia as a prof?
Yes.
Or...
Yep.
Cool beans, man.
But he's not an academic. He was the security guard at the university that had like the 10 to 6 shift. So when I'm writing at 2 in the morning, he would come around my office, make sure everything was okay. He did that a bunch of times, and it was nice.
Well,
it was
that's
nice to
awesome.
Know somebody worried about me.
So I guess, first of all, that's awesome. Doug's friend / warmer colleague on the other side of planet Earth, the down under side. And then I guess the other thing is your friend here or potentially others may not necessarily know what a maritime garden consists of. So,
yeah, that's very true.
So, and it's interesting in a roundabout way that, the security industry is sort of part of your professional milieu currently. And it's, going to be right here to here with me because I'm moving into, a small, it's a regional organization, but it's the headquarters of the regional organization. From what I understand, it's a relatively small staff. And part of, the enjoyment that I'm going to get from this role is just becoming, conversant with some of the subject matter experts that are going to be involved in developing, this e-learning training and stuff for, the security, set and whatever. So, it's neat. It's, it's like the last year and a half has not been without its own merits, shall we say, in setting this all up. And we're going to go from being a coast-to-coast show to being just a province-to-province show. Like, how far – it's like, what, a three-hour drive to PEI from New Brunswick, thereabouts, give or take, from, like, I'm sure it's less than that, but, I mean
– Here to Moncton's an hour and a half.
Hour and a half, okay, and it's about, from where I am, 2 hours to Moncton, so
– Okay, it's three and a half.
Three and a half, okay, I wasn't totally off.
Slightly less than what it is right now at like 6.5 days or whatever.
Fair
whatever
enough.
We have right now.
Well, there we go. I guess we can sort of now shift the focus here. I'm trying to think of any direct through lines to the topic, but I think the topic at hand, that you provided for us to speak to this episode, I'm just thinking of it now in terms of like this new profession that I'm entering into, and it's actually, I think, really timely. It's a really good fit for the kinds of work that I'm going to be doing, in as much as evaluation and assessment are going to be much more a part of my workflow than at any other point in my career since I was actually a classroom teacher. I've had two roles since then which didn't really have much to do with evaluation and assessment, except, sort of as a secondary piece. But now it's going to be going front and center to the learning design that I'm going to be part of. I mean, I'm making some assumptions here. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about what the topic is today, Doug?
Okay. So as part of our ongoing series of tool chest chats, our tool investigation today is rubrics.
Yes.
And I am excited because the last tool we investigated, I wasn't that excited about, but rubrics are so awesome and so helpful. It just warms the cockles of my heart to know that we get to talk about something so practical on top of everything else.
Fair enough. So, I mean, just in terms of deciding, you know, from this, on this, as opposed to, you know, whatever other kind of tool or whatever other kind of application we could have put under a tool investigation kind of thing, what was sort of the process or thought behind bringing out this as opposed to, you know, whatever else?
For my face-to-face 9-to-5 job,
yep,
I was asked to do some rubric explanations.
Ah.
And because some people had very interesting views. So I had to do the research and I had to present it and I had to do the workshop and all that. I'm like, well, I'm going to double dip. I am absolutely doing both.
We are all about double dipping. I have not had the benefit of, you know, an organizational context prior till, you know, a month from now. But, you know, double dipping in the sense for me that I was sort of copying out elements of the format for this and the punk podcast, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we're all about making the most efficient and expeditious use of existing work and building on it and or recycling up on it, depending on how you want to look at it. So I'm down with that, man, because really, when you get to it, you know, rubrics help level the playing field of evaluation.
Oh, yeah.
It becomes something that's, you know, ideally more, it gives you more feedback than just, you know, wrong, you know, right or wrong, correct or incorrect, you know, just sort of that kind of, you know, binary. But then it also, you know, it gives a framework and descriptive categories to, you know, clarify why a student in question may have gotten, you know, a C or a D, you know, or an A minus as opposed to an A, which has been contentious. You know, when I was teaching grad students, it was just like, you know, really, you're gonna, you know, you're gonna come at me, you know, because you got an A minus on a thing. So this is where the rubric is much more helpful in that way. So, you know, for sure. So, I mean, I guess before we get into your specific reasons here, your specific resources, rather, before we get into your specific resources, do you want to share perhaps some of your general thoughts on rubrics generally?
Sure. There's two things. For people that have never used a rubric,
yep.
Imagine a grid system where down one side is the criteria to be evaluated.
Okay.
Right? So that could be spelling and grammar. That could be depth of thought. That could be accuracy of the content. Whatever. Whatever those things are you're going to look at.
APA, you know.
APA formatting. Yeah, that's absolutely there too. Normally at the bottom someplace, but it's the first one that gets marked. And then going across, like if for the rows coming down or the columns coming down, it's achievement level, right? It's have yet to meet the standard, just meets the standard, quite a bit better, and then vastly exceeds the standard, or excellent, or wonderful, or whatever the title is you want to use. And so when you take a look at that grid, all those boxes get filled in. And so that gives all the feedback and all the instructions and all the guidance to the students to say, here's where we're going. And it's a contract. It's a contract between the student and the educator to say, here's where I'm going. So I deserve this in this box, this in this box, and this is how well I did. And hopefully it helps navigate the minefield of, oh, could you find me 3 more points here to get me to the A instead of the A minus? That kind of silliness.
Teacher, I need an A. This is something I heard when I was, you know, at various points in my career. You know, like, okay, but, you know, I got this char here, you know, because I was fortunate during my B.Ed. training to have teachers, educators who were, you know, instructors in that program to, you know, kind of go over this with us a bit, which again, for folks who are in educator roles but don't have, you know, like a B.Ed. training or an M.Ed. training or whatever, you know, that just might not be something that you would have inherited before venturing into your teaching role, right? I mean, this, it's no, there's no shame, there's no harm in that. It's just, so again, I'll get this out of the way now, because I know I'm going to say it later. If you do want to know more about this, you know, in a more local context for you, and perhaps in greater depth relative to your content area, you could, you know, you're always welcomed to go to your local teaching and learning center at your institution. And there are folks there who will be, you know, more than happy to kind of give you some of this discussion, but more specific to your own situation, obviously. So, you know, that's another reason that TLCs are heart, you know, that we heart them on the show. So
that's very true. Now, the utter importance of why rubrics matter now is because of the way society has gone. And the Crockett and Jackson 2018 article, The Use of Rubrics, Assessment Rubrics to Enhance Feedback in Higher Ed, helps illuminate it, and it's the first point I've identified.
Okay.
Like, I don't know what your marks were like in high school. Mine weren't wonderful.
Mine were terrible. Mine were terrible. People who knew me in high school were very surprised if they lost track of me for a few years and then found out I was a teacher, or, you know, like going this far into it with the multiple degrees and stuff. They're just like, we did not see you for that. You know, my grandparents, you know, may have made that comment, at a, you know, when I was sort of entering into this field, right? So, yeah, I was like a disengaged and unmotivated and quite frankly, horrendous high school student, although I have to say I had a lot of fun, you know, in on my own terms and in other areas.
Yeah, I didn't have as much fun, I don't think, but my marks weren't wonderful either because I just didn't care. I knew they were good enough to get to university, and that's all I wanted.
I wasn't sure that they were, and I was very lucky to have just sort of coasted by on just enough fumes to kind of get taken up into my, you know, one of my local institutions. So I, you know, I have a son who may or may not be getting himself something from the fridge right now, who's in his high school years now. And some of the communication that I've seen, you know, from his end, you know, coming from his teachers and stuff, is that for the most part, you know, K to 12 seems to be doing a pretty good job of using rubrics of kind of, so you sort of think that maybe, and for all I know, they might have been using them when I was in high school, you know, a lot, but I don't recall. I don't know. It was the 90s, you know, for me. So I'd like to think that a sort of generational shift has sort of occurred that sort of lifted up the practice a little bit. Because, again, just from what I'm seeing coming home in his backpack kind of sometimes crumpled up, otherwise not, you know, rubrics are an accepted part of K to 12 practice, and I think it'll probably be more widely used in higher ed and in other sectors too, because I'm not part of higher ed. That's going to be weird. I'm not going to be thinking to myself, spent so much time sort of being defined or thinking of myself as this higher ed person, but starting on July 17th, I'm not. I'm working in the private sector. So I'm going to be interested to see, I think it's going to be more important almost for this kind of evaluation to occur within the private sector, you know, first impressions. Sorry to detract from you there, bud, but
no, not at all. I just don't like the term higher ed because I don't believe it is.
Okay,
I think
fair
it's
enough.
Post-secondary.
Post-secondary.
That's one thing. But higher ed, there's a like a level of snootiness that sometimes people are, oh, well, I do.
Hierarchical. Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, I know it's a common term. It's just one of those things with me.
It's lazy thinking on my part. It's just terminology that just auto-populates and means that I expend less cognitive effort on the moment, quite frankly. So I quite agree with your distinction there.
So if we tried, like with my high school marks, if I tried to get into programs at a university now, I wouldn't be able to get in. Like my high school, I had a huge high school. Like we had like 1,600 students in my high school. Like it was one of those big consolidated ones.
We had 3,000 at FHS. 3,000. Okay, yeah. We like bragged on it. It was like, and I don't know if it was an urban myth or if it was actually true, but like we had the highest population, you know, in the high school per capita relative to the rest of the British Commonwealth. That was like, you know, that was the rumor that kind of like, oh, we're these urban people. It's like we were not those urban people. But due to financial extingency within, you know, a period in Fredericton, they just stacked us up and crammed us in. It was pretty interesting. But.
And my urban myth in Nova Scotia was that Sackville, Nova Scotia.
Isn't that an oxymoron, urban and Sackville? Sorry,
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. But they had so many students, they had to put them in shifts. Like school started at 7 and went from 7 to noon, and then the second shift came from noon till 5.
Dang.
So there was two shifts of students coming in. So anyway, that was the 80s. This was the 90s. But what's happened now, like this... there was two students in my class that had like a 93 average. And that was the top mark in the whole high school was these two 93s. 93 would not get you into a nursing program now if you wanted to become a nurse.
Huh.
To get into that is more now. So that is just mark inflation going wild.
And my high school marks were such that if you programmed an AI to act as a student across and just take those evaluations, the AI could do a better job than I did, for sure. And actually, when you sort of talk about what's going on in society now, you know, the first thing that kind of pinged up in my mind was AI pivot, TM. Because we got a trademark on that term, right?
Yep.
We got moral rights to it, if not proprietary rights. The AI pivot.
Absolutely.
We'll continue with sort of the resources that you prepared here, but just one of them that I want to get to, you know, that I kind of dug up for this, was, in fact, it was in Contact North, you know, their newsletter, this sort of organization associated with eCampus Ontario. They have a newsletter that comes out on various e-learning topics, various webinars and trainings and such. And then the most recent one was actually about AI and evaluation, which, you know, just kind of meshed really well with the topic today. And anyway, I'll be speaking probably to it more in the notes than necessarily right now, but again, just when I think about societal transformation now, I don't know. I've sort of gone from, maybe it's because of this podcast or maybe it's just because of seeing stuff in the social media and whatnot. I've gone from thinking about not about. I'm going to let you talk now while this resolves itself.
Okay. So part of my conversations and thoughts about like this mark inflation, we're forcing these students to get these crazy marks, right? Like 93 won't get you into a nursing program. You need a 97 or a 98 or whatever. Like that just wasn't possible when I was a student. But now we have the opposite. We have these people that we have ramped right up. And it's like, oh, you got to get these marks. You got to get these marks. And then they get into post-secondary and they're dissatisfied with the assessment. It's like because we have told them and trained them that this assessment is the most important freaking thing in the world. So, of course, they're going to act that way. Of course. And so the standardization of some of these marking rubrics will really help. It will really make life a lot better for everybody because it's like, hey, here's the grid. Here's the new standard. This is what we're doing. And hopefully that helps, because after spending a lifetime having them get ramped up, and the only thing that matters is the grade. It's like when you're at a job and you see the climbers, you know, the ones, the butt kissers, the ones that make sure they pay for their boss's drinks and all that, and they suck up to the right people.
They may exist in post-secondary education. I mean, I may have,
they do. Might have run into one or two.
Yeah.
But what happens is, it's the same thing. They get promoted into their jobs with authority, but they still act the same way. And the way they act is not caring about other people, even though their job is to try to help other people. They don't see it. Their job is to climb higher and get more power. So how do we get these students into post-secondary and then say, okay, relax about the grades? It's like, well, we can't. They just spent 18 years getting grades are the most important thing drilled into their head.
So, again, it sort of helps differentiate between learning and, achievement on a certain, kind of marking, yeah. You know, getting, a certain GPA or whatnot. One thing I'd be curious to find out from you, what I've tended to do, in my situations where I've used rubrics is, I've provided them in advance of the assignment. So, yeah. I mean, they're helpful as a sort of after, care kind of piece to sort of say, here's what you did, here's how, you qualify according to these, criteria, descriptively, but, your notion, your description of it as a kind of contract resonated with me to the extent that, when you're providing the, handout, or the general directions for, an assignment or a piece of work, providing that rubric, like when that was something that was happened for me, I'm like, okay, so I can basically, if I plan my time accordingly and sort of approach this the right way, I can basically, I need an A. I feel like I deserve, to get an A within my thing. So here's the A criteria, how it's described, how it's laid out, and you can almost use it as a foundational piece. So it works for students in the sense that, and it lets them, build out the kind of work that they want relative to what kind of grade they're hoping for. And it gives more opportunities to sort of engage with the instructor for clarification, in a formative way, as opposed to after the fact, right? Because constructive feedback at the end is very helpful, but the rubric, if it's provided in advance, it gives you that level of detail that may provide some inroads for discussion with the educator in question. I don't know if that makes any kind of sense to you there, bud.
It does. The Cockett and Jackson 2018 article. If you give the students rubrics ahead of time, they get higher marks.
Yep.
There's more accuracy in the student self-assessment. And they get higher scores in self-regulation, right? So the students do better, and they're less likely to come to you to say, oh, can you find me a couple more? Because they're like, no, yeah, that's what I did, right? And you give it to them ahead of time. And what's really cool is I'm just going to jump right to the Menendez-Varela and Gregory Geralt 2016 article.
But we're going to go back to Johnson, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay.
The next step in what the research has found recently is co-creating. You don't give the students the rubric and say, here it is. You give them the rubric and say, okay, how do we make this better? And then help to create. And a lot of people haven't done that in my experience in the past. It's here you go. It's done.
That's some very next level stuff to the extent that, first of all, it should totally be common practice what you're describing.
Yes.
And but that sort of, if that goes from kind of being something where it sort of shifts from it's an evaluation and assessment approach to something that actually is a different mindset, a different philosophical orientation a different viewpoint on, you know, what the education deal even is. So that notion of co-creating evaluation, opening it up for discussion at the very beginning, it's not tidy, it's not neat necessarily, but if you account for it in your course and your lesson planning designs and whatnot, it's just a further extension of what rubrics are themselves meant to achieve, you know. So that's yeah. Awesome that you brought that up there, bud.
Because I'm a social constructionist, right? I think learning happens when you talk to other people and you create a learning artifact. And that rubric can be part of the learning artifact. And how do you not have time to do that? Because you go and it's a Sunday night, you're powering through, you build the rubric, hand it to the students Monday morning. Well, if the students don't understand it, they're going to be asking you questions all the way through. And after the fact, you got to deal with the conversations about, oh, well, I didn't understand that. Or could you give me this? Or could you do? It's like that takes more time than building it with them in the first place. And of course, you can have a draft. You can have a draft ready for them, guide them to where you need it to be and where they need it to be, because you're the expert in whatever it is you're assessing. So you're not just going to say, yeah, I do whatever, right? You guide them to it, but that co-creation helps everybody come to grips with what the assessment is.
Well, and then just, you know, from an instructional design kind of vantage point, which I think maybe is going to be closer to, you know, my thinking than it has been in a while, you know, with this new role, one of the tenets of just, you know, good instructional design is kind of constantly iterating what you are, you know, working with. So, you know, putting out a draft, as you say, could also just be, you know, your 1.0 version. Yeah. And then you go through it with your next, you know, crowd of students, and you can present, you know, what the enhanced version, you know, that you've sort of developed, co-developed with your students from that situation. And you go, okay, again, so now, you know, you're going to version 2.0. Like, yeah. This is what worked with the previous group in your, you know, program or, you know, whatever. Does this still look valid to you? So as well as, you know, getting good buy-in and enhancing sort of dialogue and, you know, openness and transparency within your cohort, you know, giving you the stepping down from being the stage on the stage and being more the guide on the side.
Or the meddler in the middle.
Remember the meddler in the middle. Right.
That
was a while ago. The meddler in the middle. You want to go more that democratized, you know, kind of approach, then this is conducive to it. But you can also make a case for it. It's simply, you know, just constant iteration, constant development and enhancement of, you know, your learning materials, which, you know, again, from a instructional design standpoint is pretty aligned with accepted good practices too. So nothing that's being suggested here is like, you know, revolutionary as such. It's just something that, you know, it's out there, it's been there. And, you know, I kind of think of it as kind of going back to first principles of education a little bit, you know, because I've kind of put aside most of my reading because of my new kind of perspective, my getting rid of stuff and getting ready to move and take on the new role. So you can't read this from the cover at all. I'm going back to Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. This is, you know, I read it electronically before. This is just your sort of cheap everyman's library hardcover. And I'm just sort of, before I go and make all these, you know, decisions that are going to impact my life situation over there in the eastern, you know, part of the country, and my new role, I'm like, I can just revisit what has been helpful to me before. So revisiting first principles vis-a-vis Meditations, revisiting your first principles as an educator, which, you know, you can't really separate contemporary educational practice from evaluation and assessment. And if you're looking for good practices, rubrics, you know, are legit. And as Doug is sort of pointing out, and some of these authors are pointing out, it's not just like, here's a piece of paper, it's arbitrary, it's done. That's taking a good tool, but putting it for use, in my opinion, when you could be doing so much more with it, such as, you know, multiple iterations and negotiation. Right, Doug? Give or take?
Yeah. Now I got a question for you.
Sure, man. Because
you used to teach English.
Yes.
Right? You were the English teacher. And when you got them to write, when you got your students to write stuff, how often was structure involved where you're like, oh, where does this piece begin and that piece end? And how did they, like, how did you teach that stuff?
Well, you know, first of all, like, the situation that I was in largely technical writing. So as opposed to, you know, creative writing or, you know, literature or whatever. So what we tended to value was, in fact, pretty heavily structural in nature, as well as, you know, conciseness, clarity, use of appropriate formats, and consideration for appropriate audience. But to my mind, and I still, you know, in my own, you know, kind of way, use the outline, you know, your bulleted list of main topics, subtopics, and then, you know, framing that, starting with that as much as you can, and then using that as sort of the map to kind of guide your variations of writing. So was that what I was supposed to say, Doug?
I'm looking at, like, with your structure, the way you want it, you could design a rubric to say, okay, the introduction's worth 10%. The content is worth 20%. The conclusion is worth, and you can break it up so the students know if they put a heading that says introduction, we expect your introduction in there. If it's the conclusion, that goes there. As soon as I have to guess, their mark goes down.
Communications 2300 was a major report writing course at my first, you know, institution over in Qatar. And it was a course that every student had to take just about to graduate from their two-year or whatever program. And right when I was sort of getting into there, my first 2 or 3 years anyway, at that institution, one of the things that our department chair, you know, had us do is, you know, we sat down as a department and came up with the rubrics that we were going to use in that course, so that there would be consistency between what myself and my colleague down the hall were giving out in terms of evaluation and what we value. But then beyond that, you know, it wasn't just a matter of devising the appropriate categories. That was some boxes that used to be stacked that are no longer stacked. Good times when you move it.
They're organized differently.
Well, they were fine, but then my kids ended up staying almost a week longer than we intended to. And the point of this is, you know, what we ended up doing was, like, just it wasn't enough just to build it. We actually, as a group, and over, you know, like a full semester or more anyway, you know, former colleagues can maybe correct me on that. But we did calibration of it, the instrument, so that, like, we used the rubric, and then each of us, you know, had, like, the same 10 papers, and we came up with, okay, so what's a representative A paper using this? Well, B, C, D, unacceptable, you know, whatever. And we went through that a few times until, you know, as part of our process, we were all mostly marking within, you know, 5 or 10% on a grade, you know, no difference than one letter grade for sure. You know, half of the letter grade differential, maybe, using these instruments. So, like, you know, there's like designing it, and then there's, you know, putting it to appropriate use. And this may be something where if you're the only person who's teaching something or working with something, you know, then that person is you, obviously. Maybe that's not such a huge step, but this is something where if you are working with other colleagues and sort of want to share some initiative at the departmental level, you know, or even just, you know, between people who teach sort of multiple courses, multiple sections of the same class, you know, the calibration step, I think, could be pretty important.
Yeah. And that fits the ADDIE instructional design model, where you evaluate and you redo things. And part of that, when I was in teaching in Alberta, they had government exams at grade 3, yep. 6, 9, 12. And some teachers could go and do that. I didn't teach. I wasn't a homeroom in grade 3 or grade 6, so I okay. never got the chance. But they would go and they would learn how to mark collectively, the way you just described, where everybody got put in a room and was given certain papers and you had to score it within a certain percentile of the same way to make sure all the grades were the same across everybody. But the Johnson 2014 article, Rubrics and a Way to Provide Transparency and Assessment, that's what we're describing. And one of the things Johnson says is it helps the students assess their progress, structure the work, and reflect upon their own competency to complete the work. And again, it's that guide. It's give it, have it early, right? Hand them a draft at the beginning of the semester or the beginning of the year and say, here's where we're going, right? We can talk about it, but this is the structure. And having the guide helps some of those awkward conversations go away.
Well,
and they can use it as a recipe book. Like, it's a recipe. If I do this and this and this and this, I should get something edible. I should get a mark I want.
Self-regulation and metacognition and opportunities to sort of, you know, reflect as you go, and thereby, you know, learning about learning as well as, you know, learning about, you know, subject matter as such, yeah. right? Because, you know, subject matter, I mean, that can be outdated within 5 years of when you graduate in an area or yeah. sooner. It's the learning to learn, learning to navigate fluid or changing situations, you know, with an analytical or, you know, critical capability. And that's, you know, those skills are going to suit you not just in any one subject area. Those, you know, skills, you know, and habits are going to be useful whether you're taking your science class or your language class or, you know, whatever. So anything that helps further that, to my mind, is helping the endeavor along quite a lot. So, yeah. you know, as for Johnson and, you know, some of these other writers that you've sort of brought here, this is something that, you know, is it's bringing out, it's bringing out, it can be a catalyst for a lot of the stuff that we talk about on the show. Social constructionist and or other kinds of approaches that we find valuable here, right?
Yes. So, and that's it. It's what earlier in your comment, you described algebra in my world. Because you know the way you see those cartoons and it's like people are at the pearly gates and it's like, see, Mrs. So-and-so, I never used algebra. And it's like algebra is about making you think differently. It's not about X minus Y equals Z. It's about
I'm scanning through the cartoons here, or the cartoons. Your visuals at the end to see if that particular one
it's
is
not.
There.
It's not.
Okay.
It's not. You brought it out of nowhere, and I just figured I'm jumping on that one while I have the chance.
Well, all right.
And you jumped ahead. You jumped ahead to the Roy Sadler 2014 article. Futility of attempting to codify academic achievement standards. When you talk about the importance of self-regulation, self-management, and being able to assess competence, right? Like, you already covered that one, so I don't even have to talk about that one.
Well, I'm just going to say self-regulation has, you know, whatever, that's been one that I've found challenging, like, throughout my life up until, you know, whatever time it is now. Which again, you know, kind of makes it timely for me to be hitting on the meditations, not just because Marcus, you know, is necessarily such a great example of that, although he is, but the reason he's such a good example of it is he's reminding himself. He's like, yo, Marcus Aurelius, in these private notes that no one else is ever going to see, remember, you know, you got to behave in a certain way. because you haven't, but you can check it and then, you know, correct the behavior. And therefore, you know, it's a dynamic endeavor. So, again, from the private notes that this person never intended to be published, you know, 1200, whatever years ago, this is kind of coming out. So 1800 years ago, 1800, okay. Sorry. First century. Yeah. Second century. So that's the 100s.
Second century BCE. Yeah. Before the Common Era. Yeah.
No, after Common Era.
Oh, yes, because otherwise that'd be 24. You got it.
Yeah.
Okay. 22.
Anywho.
I'm with you.
You're the historian. I should just defer to that.
No, I was absolutely incorrect, so I'm glad you caught me.
I was marginally incorrect, and then I sort of guesstimated it, which is sort of how I managed to scrape out of high school with a 51 average. A charitable 51 average at the necessary math class to graduate.
I get it.
But,
So just to recap a couple of things. The Timberman et al. Article about development of a universal rubric, right? Okay. It's like prior knowledge and familiarity with the rubric improved the utility of the rubric. And it's like, okay, this is kind of a no-shit Sherlock. It's like, imagine, you know what you're going to get evaluated on, so you work towards that instead of randomly doing stuff in the dark.
Well, if you know, again, I guess the thing is, if you're a student, you know, or if you have a student, I should say, you know, if you have students who, given this kind of framework, given these kind of tools and opportunities, choose not to use them or aren't using them, you know, not only does it justify a certain kind of, you know, lower mark, but it may be evidence from the lack of awareness or lack of usage that an intervention, an academic intervention might be recommended for such students. So to that effect, you know, it can be helpful even if it's not used through its non-use, through its evident non-use of speaking to a larger set of academic circumstances, you know, so just something that what you were commenting on there kind of made me think a little bit.
No worries. So what that leads me to is the Scott and Fortune 2013 article. It's about towards the improvement of student experience. And it's like, oh, can you imagine? We actually care about students. So how are we structuring our education to help? And one thing rubrics can do, it provides them with useful and informative feedback. Can you imagine? Yes. Instead of here's the grade, here, you got a 87.5. What does that mean, right? Like, what's the pass? Like, if the passing grade's 90, 87.5 doesn't help me.
Right? Or, you know, for colleagues who, you know, in the English, you know, world, or I guess probably across the, you know, social sciences and or humanities, you know, it's like, well, it means what I was getting at with my scribbly notes in your paper, you know, for those who like mark essays. It means like all those underlines and things written by hand. And then, you know, the thing that I wrote out that you may or may not be able to read, it makes it more legible. It makes it, you know, it's, you know, for one, makes it more legible and clear. And
my goodness. Oh, man, you love this one in for me. The other thing that Scott and Fortune came up with is feedback to students needs to be improved.
Oh, yeah.
And I see the value of when I'm reading an essay or reading somebody's writing, putting like the scribbling my comment in or circling the whatever or putting the this needs to be its own paragraph or whatever those things in situ, like right in place.
Yeah.
But it also needs to, that doesn't mean you can't use a rubric as well. Right. You can do both and the structure will still help because I had a friend of mine. She and I had the same PhD supervisor. And I don't know if I told this story, but I'll tell it again anyway. She came into the grad lab. We had a lab. All the grad students kind of had their own little computers. And she said, look, as soon as I finish all these corrections, I'm done. And, like, the page was covered. Like, it was double-spaced, and my supervisor wrote in, like, super small handwriting and covered the page. And then I just happened to be seeing him the next day, and I'm like, oh, yeah, so-and-so thinks she's done. I'm like, I'm not sure she is. And he's like, no, I ran out of space. Right? Like, these were the important things. There's a lot more on the next iteration, but that message hadn't been clear, right? And I get it. They were both super people, and this lady ended up graduating, so she's Dr. So-and-so now, which is good for her. But it's, how do we improve that? How do we put the structure in place? And one thing I don't want to do is, and what I haven't done with any of the examples, is I haven't provided any examples of rubrics, right? You want to know more about rubrics? Do Wikipedia rubrics, or do examples of rubrics for your subject area. And there are hundreds of thousands of them. I was not going to curate those things.
Well, and also, you know, visiting your teaching center, as I think we've
already
mentioned.
Yes, exactly, because they've already done that curation for you. So,
and if
not?
I can just, and if I can just sort of say, one of the potential affordances or potential benefits from an EdTech standpoint of, like, learning management software, as I've come to experience it, is that you know, sometimes it you know, what the elegance or functionality of the interface sort of varies by platform, but you know, to my understanding, to my experience, they pretty much all have now some capability to plunk in or devise, you know, a pretty straightforward rubric, you know, whether you're using your colleague's, you know, example, or whether you're kind of building it from scratch. What's cool about putting it within a learning management package is that it can then be shared, you know, amongst other members of your, you know, departmental group or whatnot. Yeah. And as well, you know, there are typically, if you want to personalize it beyond, you know, hand, you know, notations and whatnot, if you're talking about a paper or a longer thing, is that you can do voice feedback as well.
Yeah.
So you can provide multimedia, you know, that goes with the rubric. So you want to just sort of do like a, you know, I'm reading this, you know, I've looked at it, I've marked it, you know, here's the rubric, and then here's me sort of speaking to it verbally, you know, to put that into a little bit of context. So, you know, contemporary learning technology does have some capability and use for this. And I know that I'm not always somebody to say wonderful things about learning management software. But again, this is just something that it's established enough as a practice. These tools, these rubrics are established enough that, you know, some template or format will exist in your local LMS that you can, you know, get started with it and tinker around and experiment or check with other colleagues and kind of, again, make these things transparent to students by sharing them out. Here's the thing, you know, plunking it into the learning management system as a file so you can look at it. So again, just to kind of, you know, just give the e-learning case as a bit of a potential example for this. So,
yeah. And like what I love right now, because my institution used Desire to Learn Brightspace.
Yep.
All the LMSs have dealt with this and most of them are pretty slick. But what I love is it's not just a checklist, right? Because there is that written explanation of the level of achievement for each criteria.
Yeah.
Right. So it's not just a, oh, he got a 3 on content and a 2 on APA and a 1 on whatever. It's not that. It fleshes out, provides the details. But what I love right now with D2L, Desire to Learn, is you don't have to put a grade on it. Like, you can build the grade in. So if you've got whatever, 4 columns across, okay, that's 10 out of 10, that's 7.5 out of 10, that's 5 out of 10, that's, you can leave it blank and you can do the score. So you can use the written text that you have in place to give the trigger for the students. And then you can put a score with it as well.
Yeah. It separates the calculation from, you know, the commenting, the feedback piece, which is helpful, right? So,
yeah. And it's, I know we're the Ed Non-Tech podcast, but the tech is there and it's helpful. Like for me, I do everything in a spreadsheet first. I build mine in a spreadsheet to make, because that's the structure that works for me and I like it. And then I make the move to put it into whatever LMS or however else I'm going to do it. But it's a technology that makes your life easier and will save you time, because I have not met somebody that enjoys marking unless like they're, I'm exaggerating, but wow. I don't think I've met one person that says, boy, oh boy, I live to mark.
something that, you know, came through that, you know, through the Contact North, you know, newsletter, Artificial Intelligence and Assessment of Learning, is that some of the links to other resources that are in there are, you know, interesting. So, for instance, there's this one tool, AI Grader by CopyLeaks. And I don't know if that's like a necessarily open source product or what, but, you know, it does. You're sort of nodding like you may have heard of this one before.
I've heard of it, but never worked with it.
So, you know, what it does is, you know, in terms of the calibration that I was sort of suggesting earlier, and we talked a little bit about, that's part of what the thing is. Like, it takes papers that you have graded as a starting point, you know, and then when it is going to do its algorithmic grading or whatever, it'll do its best to, by taking apart trends and tendencies within the human marking, it will emulate that in terms of how it then automates its marking. So if you're talking then about saving time, which is kind of what got me thinking about this, one of the major things that's sort of highlighted on this site, AI Grader by CopyLeaks, is the fact that so much time can be saved through this approach.
Yes.
But then you have to ask yourself, as with anything, if facilitated or enhanced or whatever by AI, what am I losing if I sort of, you know, let the algorithm take care of this? Am I going to be having perhaps less of a firsthand, you know, knowledge or understanding of what my students are doing? Or do I take this capability and leverage that so that, you know, I'm able to do something else more effectively? Which, again, these are maybe questions for another time, but I think
I think there's nothing wrong with using some type of software like that to create the first draft, because it's easier to edit, right? Like, coming up with the language in the first place is hard, right? It's like, you're a writer, you get it. So when you get to the editing phase, because this isn't a poem or a novella or anything. This is...
Or a set of notes for a podcast. Yeah.
Or a set of notes for a podcast. I'm going to have to try that one time. See how many pieces of literature it just makes up out of the blue. Tries to convince me you're real.
Well, it's just, you know, it's fascinating to me. Like, there's been so much of the, you know, catastrophization, if you like, about...
Yep.
The students are going to use this in ways that we can't predict and maybe illicit, you know. But then on the other side of it is, it's like, well, it can sort of help you, you know, generate multiple choice questions as opposed to just sitting there racking your tired and possibly under caffeinated gray matter for that. And, you know, it can, and then just in terms of evaluating, like actually doing the marking for you, you know, like one of the things, like with Moodle, that the iteration that they had when I was at my last institution, is that, you know, it could do grading for multiple choice, you know, real well. But then sometimes what you would end up seeing is instructors would sort of default to that form of testing because they wanted that because it could be automated and would save them time, and they had large sections of classes, and they didn't necessarily have TA support. So that goes back to
the reward structure of how post-secondary is developed.
So with this algorithmic capability, this AI capability of being able to kind of take on higher and more varied forms of evaluation, perhaps, you know, through that, it can give people more freedom and ability to come up with a wider stratagem, if you will, of evaluation. More kinds of varied assignments, more kinds of ways of doing teaching and learning holistically, rather than kind of trying to shoehorn pedagogy into a certain set of kind of test outputs and or limitations, placed by the media or tech environment. So
you're bang on. I had this conversation earlier today with a former colleague.
Okay.
And somebody brought up, oh no, AI is going to be blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, how is that different than can't use computers because that's cheating? No, you can't use calculators because that's cheating.
Or mobile or the internet at all. Yeah, totally, right?
And this former colleague of mine said, yes, writing stuff down was considered to weaken the mind back in ancient Greece. Right? People only spoke, right? You had to be a good speaker. Don't write it down. That weakens your mind to write it down, which is why when you get back to like Socrates and Plato and stuff, that was the big deal then. So this is not a new conversation. It's a new process, a new tool, a new structure. And I'd love to go into that in more depth. And we will.
But we've got some awesome visuals that you've included here. Do you want to speak to some of these visuals, bud?
Basically, the only one I really, really want to talk about is the one, the more cowbell one. The rest of them are all
Christopher Walken one.
Your assignment says one thing and you realize the rubric says something else. And it's like, oh no. what have I done? Right, you gotta make sure things the same.
And further to that, I mean, like, when you include the assignment directions and the rubrics for all of the assignments throughout the course in the syllabus, right, at the very beginning, which is what I tended to do, here's what the final assignment directions are, here's the evaluation for this, and it's all here. It's all in this one doc file. So, it's not just, you didn't read the syllabus. It's like you didn't, see the directions for each assignment. You didn't see how it was going to be marked. It's like, I'm not saying it frees you of liability as an educator, but if you want to just take the litigiousness out of it whatsoever, then I mean, this helps you in that respect, right? Doug, you've referred to, people coming at you after. Like, we've all had these moments where, like, an upset student came at you, like, after the mark was turned into the registrar, or, in my case, 2 hours before I was set to go on an airplane back to Canada, raving about their marks. It's like, no. It's like, here's the thing that you were given at the very beginning, right? So
it's the Willy Wonka meme I shared as well. Didn't follow the rubric? Tell me more how you didn't deserve that grade. It's like, yeah, you go right ahead, but I've got this that says it's... And what's interesting in rubrics is there are some students that don't like them. And the students that don't like them are the students that don't like to be assess the way everybody else is. They don't like that standard. It's like the people that get through life because they're pretty or they're funny or whatever, and suddenly they're being graded or assessed based on a standard that they've never had to attain. It's like, no. It's the kids that peaked in junior high school, right? And they've never had to. Or oh yeah, that's the boss's nephew. Right, like one of those. Oh no!
Or for
no,
the people who have made, or people who have just made a career out of like in sports, right? Flailing when to embellish the contact in NBA, or like the ones who are out to game the system, right? Work the refs. As an educator, be the ref in this case, right? Like nah. Like it's just. If bit onto one page, All the criteria were there. All the values for the criteria were there.
Yeah.
Descriptions, you know, like, you know, to get an A, exemplary APA with zero errors or, you know, only one or two. To get a B on the APA, acceptable, you know, with no more than three to four errors, you know, right down to that level of granularity. So, like, your well-connected, you know, uncle or aunt or whomever cannot help you out in this regard, son.
That's
or,
right.
Or, you know, ma'am or miss.
Or it's this is the football player.
Okay.
That's in the class because the football player needed three courses to be a full-time student. So just pass them so his GPA is up so the team does all right. Right? It's like they hate rubrics.
Right. They're committed to larger things and you're supposed to be part of that larger thing.
Yeah,
that's
it's funny, yeah, because Cock and Jackson talk about that a little bit and I really enjoyed that part.
I got a kid who is actually considered one of the top players in his sport, basketball, in Kamloops. But what he's doing with that is, much to our surprise, I think, is he's actually, you know, he's not getting the minimum marks to sort of participate. You know, he's actually kind of taking the, you know, do everything you can to your best ability messaging from the sports, and he's bringing that to his studies. His marks have gone up since participating, you know, in his high school level basketball, you know, compared to elementary, which it wasn't as much of a thing. So, you know, in this case, you know, it's a case where they're both mutually challenging environments, and it's been set up in such a way by the school, to their credit, where they're enhancing each other rather than playing off each other. And he's a smart kid. He's a sensitive kid. And he's a, you know, he's kind of just getting caught in that updraft, which has been sort of set up, you know, by the educators who run the school. So, you know, so there's like, I know exactly the kind of negative scenario that you're sort of speaking to with that relationship. And surprisingly, because of my non-involvement in sports all my life, that my kid is, you know, sort of, you know, representing, I guess, a positive tendency with that kind of deal, you know. So any chance to hype my kid on the program, really. But
oh, for sure. So that's fantastic. That demonstrates his character. That demonstrates his work ethic and what his stuff is. It also shows that, hey, sports does really help. And so often we only mention the negatives.
It's like, you know, it's sort of been put out there as like, you got your academics and you got your sports, as if they were like opposites or like, you know, antithetical to each other or somehow. But it's like, it all actually falls within the collective endeavor of a school, which is to raise kids, you know, in a holistic kind of way and, you know, get them ready for whatever they're off to next. So, you know, it's nice when the various, you know, folks in charge of setting that up and running it are kind of working harmoniously in such a way that that can occur, right? So, kudos to the K-12 educators, as always.
Absolutely.
So what's the word of the podcast?
Three more things is rubric. Nice and simple. Rubric is the word of the podcast. Phrase of the podcast was co-creation of evaluation.
Good stuff.
Because that was a priority. And my question for anybody that wants to answer is, if you could give students better feedback, why wouldn't you? Right? It's like,
totally.
It's an easy way to do it. So why wouldn't you? And my very last thing is, in my head, in my categorization of my paperwork, I'm calling this a tool chest chat, right? Because the chest and chat kind of roll off the tongue a little bit. And not a toolbox anything, because people talk about toolboxes. That metaphor is there, but anybody can have a toolbox, right? You can go to Canadian Tire or Home Hardware or whatever and buy a toolbox, but a tool chest, you can't. Like, tool chests, like, expert carpenters develop built tool chests. And that was like, to get your red seal in stuff, you would have to build a project like a tool chest. And so I see tool chest as more of an advanced standing kind of activity.
More in keeping with the social constructionist notion, in that the processes of learning are co-created and befitting of the individual circumstance, as opposed to generic capabilities. So, bespoke, contextually bound, robust, hopefully multi-purpose, multi-variable, processes developed by the people who are, using them, including, student or, end users as much as possible. The client who sort of signs off on a certain blueprint, in tandem with builders and other members of a contractor group. So I do appreciate your distinction there, bud.
Yeah. And that's literally all I have for you, other than congrats. This is the first time I've talked to you since you've had a chance to share your good news. So
yeah, hey man, well, no, I'm very pleased about this. And first of all, thanks as always for the topic. Thanks as always for the good conversation. And I'm looking forward to what all this, it's like the past year and a half has kind of been one sort of chapter. Now I got about a month of sort of transition, and then, landing in St. John and, getting reconnected with my certain people there, making new connections. And, getting off on the right footing with the new role. I mean, that's in the not too distant, and it's nice to have a paycheck and a job again, right? These despite what I may lead people to believe, these vinyl objects, they don't pay for themselves. I wish they did. I haven't quite figured out how yet. So
yeah, well, financially they don't, but they're good for the soul.
I'm getting them assessed. I'm actually going to, before I go, I'm going to get hopefully somebody from the local record shop downtown to evaluate the record collection, because I just to find out financially how much it's worth, not necessarily for selling it, but it's like, should I be carrying insurance on this?
Yes. That's
so, and that may determine what I do in terms of transportation and storage with the collection prior to moving the country. So that's where my mind is right now, which is why I've sort of put aside a lot of the in-progress reading, and I'm taking it back to first principles, so to speak. So I appreciate the opportunity, man, as always. I think probably that's it from me, except for bye for now, and see you next time.
Yeah. Bye, everybody.
Take care.